May it please the Court. Joe Luby arguing on behalf of the petitioner, John Lindsay. Your Honors, this Court has a continuing responsibility to ensure that a death sentence was not imposed under the influence of passion, prejudice, or any other arbitrary factor. And the question for today is whether this Court can sustain a death sentence and ultimately someday order that a man be executed when multiple jurors who imposed that sentence say that the bailiff told them to keep deliberating and did so at a time that the law would have required a life sentence if any one of them had called it quits and stopped deliberating.
What weight should we give to Judge Oxenhandler's master's report?
I wish I had a simple answer to that question, but it depends upon the type of claim that the Court is considering, and I've tried to lay that out in our briefs. But if the Court is considering this case under its ongoing review to ensure that no arbitrary factor contributed to the sentence under the Amrine case and also under Section 565.035.3, then the question is simply whether the evidence presented is sufficient to undermine this Court's confidence in the trial's outcome. And that would not necessarily allow you to just completely intrude upon any credibility finding and just to necessarily have it be completely de novo. But at the same time, that standard still makes clear that the Court has to exercise independent judgment and determine for itself whether the evidence is sufficient to undermine the Court's confidence in the trial's outcome.
But the master made credibility determinations that we aren't permitted to make, and the numerous persons that he interviewed, jurors, other persons in the courtroom, judge, the bailiff, came up with credibility determinations that Mr. Winchell's claim was not credible.
And to the extent that those are determinations that are made on credibility, the demeanor of the witnesses, the kinds of things that this court is not particularly competent to assess, we are not asking for those kinds of credibility determinations to be reassessed. What we are simply asking for is for the Court, for this aspect of Mr. Winfield's claim, to exercise its independent judgment and to determine for itself whether it believes the evidence is sufficient to undermine the verdict. The other aspect of the claim, Your Honor, it isn't this Amrine theory, but is instead the more straightforward constitutional theory that what this jury did was render a de facto life verdict by saying we are split or we are deadlocked, and then was told to keep deliberating. Now, if that is what happened, then the question of what level of deference do we give to the master's findings has a little bit more importance on the ultimate issue of that constitutional question. Now, the petitioner's position is that the choice of a standard of review in that instance isn't really outcome determinative. Even under the more deferential review that's been proposed by the respondent, the Court would still have the power to assess, and in fact the obligation to assess, whether there are clear errors in the report. For example, things that are just plainly contradicted by the plain language of the transcript. I've pointed out a number of those in the brief. The problem really in this case, as Your Honors are aware, is that of course the evidence is in conflict. This trial happened 11 years ago, memories fade. It's entirely possible that some of the jurors didn't hear what was said, or that they didn't all understand it the same way. But the real problem is, even with the master's report, there is still no reasonable explanation of why multiple jurors would remember being split, would remember saying we're split, and would remember being told to keep deliberating if that didn't happen. The report doesn't explain that. The evidence doesn't explain that. The respondent has never explained that. There's no evidence these jurors were in cahoots. There's certainly no evidence or indication that they are fabricated.
There is a suggestion on the record that by one of the jurors or a couple of the jurors who said that the bailiff said, keep going while I get your dinner or whatever, or there was a suggestion that if something was said, it was a procedural advice that, no, you don't have to stop while I'm getting dinner. You can keep deliberating, and that might be the kind of thing that would not be said to the group as a whole. But I'm trying to figure out, everybody seems to presume, what was the evidence as to if the bailiff talked, did he talk to the whole room, or did he talk individually to jurors? what would be the circumstance where some might have heard something and not others? Can that be explained by someone asked the bailiff a question, or was there evidence that all their interactions were as a group?
The evidence would be that all their interactions were as a group, but it's still entirely possible that some of the group were more tuned in to exactly what was being said than others. Let's take the example of where Juror Tina Tracy testified that the bailiff came in, by the way, while he was delivering dinner, not while he was making
the
arrangements for dinner.
That,
yes. Yeah. And what she said was that the bailiff said to keep it up or keep deliberating. And she clarified that although that was a procedural comment, that she took that to mean, and the other jurors took that to mean, that they should keep deliberating. Not until the food comes, but until, she said, until we were able to reach our decision. And that is what she said the bailiff told them. That's on page 188 of the transcript. It's on page 15 of the appendix.
But assuming for the moment that we thought that had occurred, is that sufficient to be a hammer instruction, or does it have to be sufficient to be a hammer instruction to be prejudicial or to require a new trial or a new sentence?
That would depend on the circumstances. And under these circumstances, with a number of jurors saying, oh gosh, there was an instruction that we needed to keep deliberating, and there's no evidence that at the time this occurred that the jury was yet unanimous. Under those circumstances, it is entirely reasonable to assume that the jury was either at an impasse or possibly near an impasse. And
where do we get that from, that assumption?
That assumption is from the testimony of three jurors who say that the jury, in fact, reported that it was deadlocked. There's a fourth juror who says that the jury discussed whether or not to tell the judge that they were divided about the vote. And another juror says, yeah, the bailiff probably did come in and say to continue deliberating, but he wasn't really sure. And what the court, the extent, the evidence that the court believes really drives what the proper remedy is. If indeed the bailiff just said something very mild, something to the effect of, oh, hey, keep at it, then the evidence at most would show at least some of the jurors who thought they were deadlocked or near it, continued their deliberations on the bailiff's account, and there is then the possibility that any one of those jurors could have said, hey, I would have been done, or I was done, and had that happened, the sentence would have been life. That scenario wouldn't preclude a retrial, but it would at least justify the court in vacating the sentence of death and ordering a retrial. If, on the other hand, what the court believes is that the jury went all the way, as testified to by Juror Turner, Juror Willie, and Juror Daniels, and actually reported a split vote or a deadlock vote, and the bailiff said, you need to keep deliberating, that is the functional equivalent of a verdict that says, we are deadlocked. And in that sense, the situation should be as though that were the verdict. And if that had been the verdict under Whitfield, Mr. Winfield would have been sentenced to life. So that's a very long-winded answer to Your Honor's question, but the remedy would depend on the evidence that the court chooses to believe. I'd just like to emphasize that there is a confusing question in this case about the level of deference to give the magistrate's finding. The briefs argue, and Mr. Hassel and I can certainly argue, about what additional evidence would be required, even above a preponderance of the evidence, for me to overcome the master's findings. But the much more straightforward issue is, I believe, the court's ongoing responsibility to ensure that this particular death sentence was not the product of passion, prejudice, or any arbitrary factor. That is necessarily a question for this court. The question under Amrine and under that statute is whether the court's confidence in the trial's outcome has been challenged, not whether the magistrate's confidence in the outcome has been challenged. And it is the court, and not the master, that is ultimately responsible for administering the death penalty and for someday scheduling a death sentence in a case. And with that, unless there are further questions, I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Haskell.
May it please the court, Andrew Haskell on behalf of the respondent in this case. Here, this court appointed Judge Oxenhandler special master and ordered Judge Oxenhandler to conduct a hearing and write findings of facts and conclusions of law based on the evidence presented at that hearing. Judge Oxenhandler did so. He found that there was no note sent from the jury to the judge or any communication from the jury to the bailiff indicating a deadlock. He did so after considering all of the evidence presented in the hearing. That factual determination is entitled to this court's deference.
It's not binding on us, though, is it?
I believe
it's not like a jury verdict, or that we're not required by any of our rules to treat it like a jury verdict or a judge's findings below.
Well, this court in State X. Rel. Bush by Whitson v. Bush stated that this court gives the master's findings of fact the same weight and deference given to trial courts in court-tried cases. And that's what happened here. So, yes, it's entitled to the same deference as in a Rule 29-15 proceeding or in a trial, court trial.
Did it overrule the prior cases saying otherwise?
It didn't expressly overrule the prior cases that said otherwise.
So do we have two lines of cases we could take this opportunity to clarify?
I think that the court could take this opportunity to clarify. But I would urge the court to clarify and to give deference to a master's findings. A master sits and hears the evidence. And in this case, this habeas action, in essence, it is a Rule 29-15 action where he did the same things that a judge in a Rule 29-15 action would do, hearing the evidence, considering the evidence. And this court should give him the deference that it would give a court in a Rule 29-15 action. Especially as this court asked him to submit findings of fact and conclusions of law. And when this court does so, I think this court owes deference to what the court asked for the judge to do below.
Opposing counsel says a number of the witnesses said they just didn't remember if there was a note or not, and the master inaccurately said as if that were an affirmative no note was given, they recalled that no note was given.
They didn't remember that any note was given. Nearly all of those witnesses said that the jury was not at any time deadlocked.
Yeah, no, I know, on that issue, but I'm the note issue. Was the how many witnesses actually said we did not give a note as opposed to, gosh, it's been 10 years, I just don't remember us giving a note.
I believe that there were 4 witnesses that definitively said no note. 3 witnesses said there was some form of communication. The other witnesses couldn't remember whether there was a note or not.
Okay.
With varying degrees of, I don't believe that there was a note, down to, I simply just don't remember. But here we have a case in which the trial judge testified that she never received any note, any communication from the jury stating that they were deadlocked. Bailiff testified that he was never told by the jury that they were deadlocked. And 9 jurors stated that they did not believe that there was ever a deadlock. And I wanted to clarify this because non-unanimity in a jury room during deliberations is expected in our system. The fact that the jurors, when they first step into the jury room, are not unanimous about what the proper result in a case should be does not indicate a deadlock. It indicates merely that the jurors need to discuss the instructions with each other, to discuss the evidence with each other, and to consider that evidence as a group. In other words, to deliberate. It's exactly what happened here. The jurors, over the space of several hours, went through the instructions, they went through the evidence, and they determined to impose sentences of death on Mr. Winfield. That's exactly how the system is supposed to work. And that's how it worked here. To claim that the jury is deadlocked simply doesn't meet what the majority of the jurors say was occurring in that jury room. They simply were not unanimous at the beginning. They became unanimous towards the end. And the only definite statement that we have from the bailiff to the jury was when he was bringing in dinner, of keep deliberating till you get your answer. Heaven knows that bringing in boxes of food for the jury with the bailiff and perhaps some assistants, not all of the jurors are going to hear that conversation. But Jared Tracy was adamant when asked that that was not regarding whether the jury was deadlocked or not. And in fact, the jury had never told the bailiff that they were deadlocked. It's hard to see how a hammer instruction, which requires deadlock, could flow out of that one statement, which was procedural. Go ahead, eat, take your time, deliberate. And that's all that happened here. And Judge Oxenhandler thoroughly reviewed the record, weighed the testimony that was before him, and held that there was no such note. And I wanted to move on to this court's continuing obligation to examine the evidence in death penalty cases. If the court accepts Judge Oxenhandler's factual findings that there was no such note, it's hard for me to see how that would affect the sufficiency of the evidence at trial. If there was no such note, there was nothing improper that happened with the jury, there's no reason for the court to have any doubt about the constitutionality of the death sentence.
So are you agreeing we have that obligation, but that it's satisfied here because...
Exactly. There's no reason to have any doubt because the alleged constitutional violation never occurred. And there's no question as to the guilt here. The only question is, was there some sort of instructional error? Under the facts of this case, as Judge Oxenhandler found, there isn't. So there's no reason to doubt further if there is any reason not to set an execution date or otherwise proceed with the case. I again think that it's important to point out here that even under a more lenient standard of review, there is sufficient evidence to uphold what Judge Oxenhandler found. The testimony of the three jurors that claim there's some sort of communication is inherently, they don't agree with each other. There's just something happened. There may have been a note. The bailiff might have said something. There's no agreement among them. And in fact, one of the jurors, Juror Wiley, 10 years after the fact, even thought the judge came in during deliberations and told them to keep deliberating. When we're dealing with 10 years past from jurors who probably do not understand all the legal significance of what happens in a trial here, asking for more evidence than what we have here would be very difficult. There's sufficient evidence from the judge, the bailiff, the foreman, and jurors who did remember, that's crystal clear, this didn't happen. There was no note. There was no hammer. And if there are no more questions from the court, then I would ask this court to deny the petition for habeas corpus.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Does the court have to find that the bailiff knew the jury was deadlocked in order to get into the cases regarding a hammer instruction?
No, because under the State versus Griffin case, the argument that we've made is that that kind of directive, whether or not the bailiff knew about it, the bailiff would have still been unintentionally interfering with the jury's determination of whether it was going to stop deliberating or keep deliberating. Griffin makes clear that decision has to be made by the jury, and if the bailiff even unintentionally comes in and says, hey, keep at it, and some jury, under a setting where the jury is split, and some of the jurors take the bailiff's comment a certain way, then the bailiff has pretermitted the jury's determination of whether to stop deliberating or keep deliberating. And so in that sense, it's different from an actual hammer, but it's still a legally significant ex parte contact, albeit an unintentional one made in good faith, which is really not something that should be that surprising that that would happen, that a remark like that might be made. I'd like to pick up on Mr. Hassel's analysis that review should be just as if this were a Rule 29.15 case. Accepting that premise for a moment, Mr. Hassel has concurred with me that Juror Tracy said that the bailiff said, keep deliberating until you get your answer, and not keep deliberating until the food came. Well, maybe Judge Otzenhandler wouldn't have even made this same finding had Judge Otzenhandler not been under the misconception that it is now conceded that he was under. Mm-hmm. Similarly, Juror Jenny Daniels, the special master says that Juror Daniels only said something as to what the bailiff said, but in fact, on page 71 of the transcript, Juror Jenny Daniels said that the bailiff said to keep deliberating. And so in that sense, if indeed review is the same review that would be applicable under Rule 2915, this court, in exercising its independent judgment, would still be able to and should assess the clear errors in the record that are made in the report. Overall, the circumstantial evidence is that this was a tendentious and fractious deliberation. There's some testimony that the jurors even went from 8-4 for life over to 12-0 for death. There's testimony that it was highly emotional, that it was charged, that some of the jurors were crying. And all of this tends to support the idea that the jurors were either at or near a deadlock. And there is a chance, a reasonable chance here, that the jurors continued deliberating because the bailiff told them to. And it is in that sense that the court should and has the obligation to assess whether its confidence in this trial's outcome has been undermined. And if so, it needs to, at the very least, vacate this death sentence and order a new trial in which, if Mr. Winfield is to be ordered to be put to death, it will have been because the jury will have reached that decision of its own accord. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted.